Welcome to Made in Science, the official podcast of the University of Stuttgart. In our podcast series, IRIS, which is the interchange forum for reflecting on intelligent systems here at the university, has come up a couple of times already. The research conducted by IRIS is very interdisciplinary and focuses on changes in such areas as work, education, society, all of which are triggered by an increasing presence of intelligent systems. To shed some light on the effects of intelligent systems, Dr. Cornelia Zindermann is visiting the podcast team today. She works in the area of computational digital psychology, where she has been an independent research group leader at the University of Stuttgart since 2023. Great meeting you, and thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really looking forward to talking about my research with you.
Perhaps it would be best today if you introduce some of your main areas in your research yourself.
Oh yeah, I would like that. So in broad, my research is in between psychology, my core discipline, but also political science, media and communication, and computer science. And in particular, I'm interested in how technology, so intelligent systems like large language models, recommender algorithms, how do they change how information is created in the online context? How is it distributed? And how is it presented to individuals? And then I'm interested in how individuals with different characteristics, how do they now consume this newly presented information in terms of how do they cognitively process it, and how do they build their political opinions based on it, and how do they politically behave? So it's all about this technology-person interaction on political opinions and behavior.
Now, the word information catches my attention here. When reviewing your work, the concept information comes up quite frequently. I wonder if you have a working definition for the term information.
Well, actually, no, I do not have a working definition. And to be completely honest, I wouldn't even know what the exact definition in dictionaries is. So when I use information, when I talk about my research or in my research papers, I'm using it as a very broad umbrella term, encompassing all kinds of content. So I'm not making a statement, for instance, about the accuracy of the information. So I include both misinformation and true information. I also include any kind of information, like it can be news, but it can also be an opinion statement or a comment from a user. It can also come in different modalities, like audio, visual, text, and things like this. So I'm saying here, really, I use it as a broad umbrella term.
And when we use this broad term, however, how do you measure, or is that defined, the usefulness, if that term exists, of information? Can it be measured at all? Or is this totally subjective and depends on the individual?
Well, I think to a certain degree, you could say that some information may be more or less useful. So, for instance, a completely inaccurate or untrue piece of information may not be useful to be incorporated in an individual's belief or knowledge system. But here we then again already see what you mentioned. It depends on what the information is supposed to be useful for. And also, as you said, it depends on the individual. So different individuals judge the usefulness of the same piece of information very differently, depending on what they want to do with the information, their existing beliefs, their knowledge, and things like this. So it is definitely depending on the individual and the situation, yes.
Sometimes you have called the individual people.
Yes.
And I wonder here, do you mean people across all cultures and regions? Or is your research primarily focused on Western societies?
I would like to draw conclusions about all the people across the world, but let's face it, this research in the area I'm working on, and my research also, is very much focused on the Western, educated, industrialized, rich and democratic countries. So yes, the research in this political, psychological and media and communication research is very much focused on those weird countries, especially the US. And also my own research is mostly in German and US samples. So while we are trying to draw conclusions for individuals across the globe and generalizable conclusions, we have this issue that our research is mostly focused on weird samples. So while some of the findings in this research have also been replicated in studies outside of weird countries, most of it actually was conducted and is applicable to the weird countries.
And once that you know that kind of area that you're working in, and geographical area for that matter as well, do you or are you in contact then with researchers in your field of work on other continents that do the same, so that you have some comparison?
I did some cross-cultural studies in the beginning of my PhD in Germany and China. However, that was a completely different topic from what I'm working on right now. Currently, my collaborators are mostly in Europe, the US, or New Zealand, which are different continents, but still not super diverse in the setup.
I have watched an interview with you on YouTube by Deutsche Welle, and there is discussion about the relevance of text versus image. Please, could you elaborate a little more on how this relation plays out in media culture specifically?
Yes, of course. So the important thing here is that images can transport emotions very quickly and with very little effort for the person looking at the picture, much more than text can do it, because text you need to read, you need to cognitively process it to kind of also feel the emotion. So pictures are much quicker in conveying emotions, and they are also attention grabbers, which is probably also one of the reasons why on social media most news headlines are always accompanied by a picture, because it grabs your attention and makes you maybe also want to read more.
I could only agree with that, because when I visit websites, say news websites, the text blip that I read first is always in combination with an image. And yes, I see the image first normally. So would you opt for saying, actually, when it comes to news, for instance, there should not be an image? Would that be a more objective, less emotionally charged way of sending out information?
I think that's a very general statement. I think it is good to have pictures accompanying news, because they can grab attention also to important information and important news. In this case, I would say it's good that we have a picture that grabs our attention. However, it very much depends on the picture, for instance. So, for instance, does it fit to the text, to the piece of information that is presented? Does the emotional valence fit? Is it maybe too negative? That might also be bad. But if it's neutral or just aligning with the text, it might be very helpful, actually. On the other hand, if you have a piece of information that's maybe qualitatively not as high, or something like clickbaiting, maybe you wouldn't want a picture there, because it's not as interesting to read the information after all. So what I'm saying here with these examples is it very much depends, I think. In general, pictures can be very helpful to grab attention to important information, but at the same time, obviously also be used for attention grabbing for not as important information.
And when it comes to information, what about the length of it? Mm-hmm. Recently in Germany, there was a discussion about the length of the main edition of the news program Tagesschau. The debate was whether to extend the broadcast from 15 to 30 minutes. For now, as I understand it, the result will be, or is, that it will stay with 15 minutes. But given the complexity of today's world, would you advocate for a longer format to cover more, to explain more, to share more information? Or is there any research that says 15 minutes or less is exactly what we need?
That's an interesting question, and I have to admit I haven't completely made up my mind about this Tagesschau issue. So obviously there are the pros that I totally get, which is what you said. Like, our world is complex. A lot of things are happening across the world, and they are very complicated. So is 15 minutes really enough time to talk about all of this? Probably not, let's face it. 30 minutes would provide much more time to talk about more different issues and more in-depth about specific issues. So I see this really as a pro. On the other hand, we also need to make sure that individuals and people are actually watching the Tagesschau for 30 minutes. And I would assume that many individuals may just not do this and maybe leave watching the Tagesschau after 15 minutes to watch some other kind of movie that starts at 8:15 p.m., which is the time where usually today the Tagesschau stops. Or also that they just don't want to invest that much time in the Tagesschau because they have this anchor effect. They know the Tagesschau now for 15 minutes. It was like this forever, kind of. So why would we change it? So while I see the pros, I would also be a bit concerned that the people are not actually watching the Tagesschau for 30 minutes. And also, given that there are oftentimes specific TV shows on specific issues to discuss them in more depth, like the Brennpunkt, I think it's the name, individuals that are very interested could watch the Tagesschau to get this short wrap-up of the most important information. And in addition, watch the Brennpunkt to gain more information on further topics. And the ones that are not willing to watch the Brennpunkt, they would still have 15 minutes, a very dense and short summary, at least, of the most important information. So maybe that is already the way to go. But again, as I said, I haven't completely made up my mind on this question. Maybe we should just test and see what happens if the Tagesschau is extended for 15 minutes, so to 30 minutes.
And maybe we can also leave it up to the people, really.
Exactly.
Is the amount of news that people consume something that they actually learn to regulate over time? For example, do younger audiences feel perhaps adequately informed with less content? Is there a learning process in this strategy? Is there a strategy that people have and then change perhaps as well to feel really well informed?
I think there can definitely be a training mechanism. So you can train to read or watch the news for longer. So the more you read, the easier it gets. It's true for news. It's true for scientific articles. So you can train this, but you obviously can also untrain this. So if you don't train it, you might lose the capability of reading news for a very long time and may become okay with just reading short news pieces for a small amount of time. So yes, I think there is a kind of learning or training here involved. However, it's not only about like the maximum capacity that you can build up by training or not. It's also about what individuals actually want. What are their preferences? What are their needs? So even if they may be able to read news for 5 hours a day, maybe that's just not their preference. And what their preferences and needs are, that depends on many different factors, like their social environment, their individual differences, their news environment or information environment overall. So there's one study, I think, from Switzerland, because you also refer to younger people, that examined how younger people read news. And they've basically found, very roughly summarized, that kids up until the age of 14, they mostly consume the news in whichever way their parents basically tell them, or schools, and like depending on the media that is available to them at home. Then from 15 to 17, social media becomes one of the most important sources of information. And then starting 18, 19, 20, they build other habits that tend to stick with them. And that's mostly for now. So the individuals that are now 18 to 20, they mostly use different apps and social media to consume news. And this is Of course, not only what they can do, but also what they learn from their social environment and what they learned works for them. However, maybe also one important point about this question is not only the time, so how much news do we consume, but what kind and what is the quality of the news we consume. So someone may consume 5 hours of complete rubbish, quote unquote, news, which would be 5 hours a lot, but maybe still not as useful to gain knowledge as 15 minutes of Tagesschau. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. That brings us also to two other terms that mm-hmm. I think we can talk about here. One is pre-bunking and one is debunking. Please, could you share some background and some explanation concerning these two terms with what you just said about the content that of information that people actually access?
Yes, I just talked, among others, about news that may be not of very good quality, and pre-bunking and debunking classically comes from the misinformation research. And when we talk about these things, it's all about interventions to support individuals in becoming better in differentiating between true and untrue or fake or incorrect information. And pre-bunking are all those interventions that are used before individuals actually encounter misinformation. And debunking is what is done afterward. So if we start from the back with the debunking, I think we all know this. This is when a specific misinformation is used, for instance, by Correctiv, and then they explain in detail that this information is wrong, why it is wrong, and then provide information supporting and proving that this misinformation is indeed wrong and telling the listeners or the readers what actually is the correct information. That's debunking, taking a very specific, already published misinformation and explaining why it is wrong and what the correct information is. And this has been done a lot because it's simple and extremely important to clarify what of the information out there is true and what not. The issue is, it's also always behind. It always comes after the misinformation is already published, and this can be problematic in terms of effectiveness of these interventions. Some things people just believe also when they are told it's wrong, and we have this what we call an illusionary truth effect, which means just because information is repeated, we tend to believe it more and think more of it as true. And when we do debunking, we have to repeat the misinformation, which can have this very strange effect of people believing it more afterward, actually. And that's why researchers in the past years have focused more on this pre-bunking. So in general, you could summarize this as helping people to become better in differentiating true and fake before encountering it. So for instance, we have these boosting strategies where we generally try to teach people, for instance, media literacy. So it is important for you to compare information across sources. Where do you find reliable information and things like this? So very broadly. And we have this new technique of inoculation, where we try to explain and confront individuals with the strategies used in misinformation. So for instance, very emotional language, and teach them to recognize these strategies in other information later on. So when after the training, they see a piece of information that's, for instance, written in a very emotional way, in their head, there is kind of the signal saying, oh my God, emotional language. Maybe this is not correct information. Maybe I should cross-check this information. So this is pre-bunking. And as I said, there are different strategies. And it seems to be very effective because it is already teaching people to be more aware and think more of true and fake before they actually encounter misinformation.
Mm-hmm. And that pre-bunking would also take away this boomerang effect that you described when about information that is not correct but is repeated all the time and then has to be taken up and corrected, and that needs to get, first of all, the attention of everybody to actually follow this one. An important theme in your work is digital political participation. And I wonder, does that also involve learning how to filter information more effectively? Are people more skeptical of political information than about other types of information?
I'm not aware of a study directly comparing skepticism to different kinds of information. However, information consumption and political participation can definitely be related, at least on a theoretical level. So I think we all agree kind of on the fact that the internet, in theory, provides a huge breadth and depth of information that individuals can consume to become very well informed about diverse issues, also in a political sense, or become very well informed about specific issues. And this can increase, of course, also their confidence in political participation. And this can also then lead to more political participation of those individuals, both online and offline, because they feel more capable of doing so. However, when I say this, we also need to keep in mind that just because in theory there is this breadth and depth of information on the internet, it doesn't mean that individuals are actually consuming a lot of information online and a lot of diverse information. So I think we've heard of those buzzwords, filter bubble, echo chamber, whatever you want to call it. But it is a fact that on the internet we have recommender algorithms that filter information for us, for instance, on social media. We also, of course, have our social network of friends and family that recommend certain pieces of information or news to us. And please, we should never forget, me as a psychologist, often I pronounce this, we ourselves, we are very good at filtering our own information and deciding of what we want to read or watch and what we do not want to read and watch. And all those filtering mechanisms, so algorithms, social, and what we do ourselves, they kind of interact online and can create a homogeneous information environment. And I'm not saying that people are only consuming information aligning with their attitudes. We are past this. But for some individuals, yes, they consume more information aligning with their interests and beliefs. And while this is okay and nice when it's about cat versus dog videos on social media, it can, of course, become problematic when it's about politically relevant information. So what I'm saying here is, there is this possibility that the information that's available online provides us with the necessary information and also confidence to participate in the politics, but not for everyone and not all the time.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider leaving us a rating and sharing it with a friend or colleague. It really helps us grow and reach more people interested in science and research, and we truly appreciate it. One very big information system, if it can be called that, is ChatGPT. Being at a university, we wonder, of course, how students are using it. In your mind, what are sensible, productive ways to use artificial intelligence tools like this? Should we be teaching students to cross-check AI output with their own knowledge or other sources?
To the last question, yes. The other questions, so first up, I'm definitely against forbidding students to use AI because it's just a technology we should be able to use in a sensible way, as you mentioned. And about the question, what is sensible? So what I learn from how I'm using AI, which is, of course, only a very small and narrow field. But what I learned is, first up, always be skeptical. Check the output of the model against what you already know, but also against other sources. Also, never let the AI do everything for you blindly, but try to collaboratively work with the AI. So together, find a good solution. Don't let the AI just do everything for you. At least from my experience, I can say that often leads to very bad outcomes. Whereas when I work something out and then try to improve it with the help of AI, that's often much more useful. And also, I would say, find the right tool for different tasks. Because everyone these days is talking about ChatGPT, and I agree, it's a fun and cool tool, but only for certain tasks, it's really helpful. There are other AI tools for other tasks that are much better for specific tasks.
In the aforementioned Deutsche Welle interview, you mentioned that some people avoid negative information or negative news because they find it just too hard to deal with. What does the research know about the impact of negative news? What are some of the psychological consequences? And then with the technology around us, again, how can we better approach this issue so that this feeling of living in a negative world is not a dominant one?
Yeah, I think first up, but I think also said in this interview that you mentioned, the news and journalists, they are also responsible for telling the broad public what goes wrong and what is wrong in the world. So yes, some news must be negative because, and that's another thing, I also think what is happening these days in the world, there is a lot of bad things that are happening with wars, climate change, and things like this that we should be aware of. And yes, this can, of course, lead to negative emotions in individuals, fear, anxiety, for instance, sadness. And this can, for instance, also increase stress responses in terms of cortisol. And for some individuals, what you said may happen. They may try to avoid news overall just to basically protect themselves and their mental health from the negative impacts like increased stress, negative emotionality. Others, however, might do the very opposite and start what we call doom scrolling, like consuming only negative or increasingly negative news and content as a kind of trying to gather information trying to gain information as a sense to get control back. And this can again, of course, however, still increase negative emotions, which might be kind of becoming a circle. Like I read more negative news, I'm becoming more fearful. I try to make up for it by getting more information to feel control, which means I do more doom scrolling, more negative emotions, more doom scrolling, more negative emotions. You see where I'm going with this, right? So I think that can happen definitely, yes.
Your academic background, as we just heard again, is psychology. In your life, at what point in your career did your focus shift or expand or actually find its way from psychology to IT, to politics, to marketing? These are very interdisciplinary areas as well. Can you, for yourself, identify a particular moment or event that triggered your interest, your transition from psychology to cover more?
I cannot make up one specific point in my life or in my career where I got interested or started getting interested in those topics. But I think roughly it was in the end of my PhD when I started becoming more and more interested in how individuals behave online. And I quickly realized that different technologies, different online platforms have differing effects on different individuals. So some people use social media and are super happy and others use social media and they are not. Some people use social media and become polarized in their political opinions. Others use social media and become more moderate in their political opinions. And this interaction between technology and individual differences was what caught my attention. And I think the first two topics I was interested in were recommender algorithms on social media and this whole echo chamber filter bubble topic, and what we called back then fake news. Because I remember that I did a very crappy US-American fake news test on the internet, which had a lot of news headlines from the US. And I basically, as the participant in this test, had to say if it's true or not. And many of those news I just had no clue about because it was from some specific state in the US. And, well, I have to admit, I didn't do very great. And I told this to my colleague and said, like, why am I not good at this? I mean, maybe here I didn't know these things for specific US states. And then he was like, oh, yeah, we should investigate this. What makes people good and bad in recognizing what's true and what's fake? And it was years back when this was not a topic at all in the media. And I think this test, it was like, yeah, you know, you say research is me-search. That was definitely one of these situations in my academic career.
I hadn't heard that term before. Research is me search, but I will remember. So you talked about the content. I wonder if it also needed a special time to highlight your particular research. And I'm thinking of COVID-19, of course. In how far did the pandemic influence, also what you do in your research? Because I think that was a particular time when people were exposed to all kinds of information and were also looking for all kinds of information. So to put it bluntly, was COVID-19 a fortunate time for your research?
I wouldn't go that far. However, COVID-19 definitely put a spotlight on the kind of research I did, meaning that other researchers and the politics, but also the broad public, of course, became much more interested in the research or in the kind of research that I was doing. And it also increased the research output from other researchers, which made it, of course, also easier for me to then again build on their research. So in a sense, it helped my research, but I wouldn't say it was a good time still.
From a historical standpoint, the time since the availability of the internet culture isn't really long. And yet it seems to have such a strong psychological influence on people. But I also wonder, are we overestimating our current stage of technical development and its consequences? What do you think? Could we perhaps still be in the very early phase of this development? And if so, what does that mean for research going forward?
Yeah, I think we are still in the early stages of technological developments. However, the internet is already incorporated in like every part of our lives with like smartphones, tablets, smartwatches, smart fridges, smart TVs, and so on. So there is definitely a lot still to come. And also given the speed with which technological process is happening these days, I'm sure there is a lot more to come. So even though we are in the early stages, I think we should be aware of the huge impact it could have. And I think researchers should be aware of this, and the public also. And I often think it is important for us as independent researchers at public institutions, for instance, also to look at big tech, which is not easy because they're not very transparent about what they are doing. But we should try to keep up with them and examine all the consequences that the technologies that big tech puts out there may have on society. And I'm not saying that all the consequences we fear are definitely also happening like we are fearing that they are. But we should at least investigate them and see what are the consequences.
And from a psychological perspective, at what age or stage of development should media literacy or data literacy education begin to help people navigating in this particular thick forest of information?
I'm not a developmental psychologist, so I might give you a very naive response to this question. But in general, I would think the moment individuals start using digital or devices that are connected to the internet, they should also learn how to use them, how to handle their data, how to protect their data. And as far as I know, that's often already in elementary school or right after elementary school. So that would probably be my naive answer to that.
And when we look at research in general, I'm also wondering towards the end of our conversation here, what will be the next direction in your research? Have you anything particular in mind upcoming in the next years?
Yes, I will definitely look more into the interactions between new technological developments. So currently that's large language models, for instance, and how they interact with individual characteristics to impact political opinion formation of those individuals. So we just have a new study published, for instance, as a preprint, so not officially published, I have to say this, where we investigated how individuals engage with large language models when they discuss political topics. And I think given the technological innovations that are published, I don't know, by the second, I feel, I'm pretty sure I will have a lot of research to do in this context also in the upcoming years. And I also think, and maybe you noticed this in some of my responses also, oftentimes it's much more complex than we in the beginning than we expected. Like, it's not the internet making us all addicted to it. Or it's not the internet making us all polarized individuals. It's much more complex. And I'm also trying to kind of grasp this complexity and try to better understand all the mechanisms that are at work, impacting some individuals in this way and other individuals in another way.
Well, we have something less complex for you right now.
Okay.
The final moment in our conversation is called Moment 7. We have collected 7 questions that we would like to ask you, and please answer each of them as shortly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Moment 1. Spätzle or Maultaschen?
Spätzle.
Moment 2. Please finish the sentence. One thing you could change about the world would be...
Well, maybe just in line with this interview, making people better in dealing with information.
Moment 3. Do you have a recommendation for a book, a movie, music, theater, museum visit you can share? Doesn't have to be related to your work, but something that is on your mind.
So if it's related to my work, my students, I always recommend The Social Dilemma on Netflix. It's a documentary that very easily, but also surprisingly accurately, explains a lot of like the interactions on social media, of how data is used. But if it's not related to my work, I really like the books by Andreas Eschbach, and I just started reading a book which is about how terrible we are in predicting the future. And I'm not very far in this book, but for now it's really interesting seeing how individuals for now failed to predict future.
Moment 4. The best advice that you have ever received was?
Don't worry too much about what others think about you.
Moment 5. Your favorite place at the University of Stuttgart is?
The beach bar at the campus in Feigen.
Moment 6. Again, please finish the sentence. If I could start all over again, I would do the following differently.
Maybe I would start early on in my studies to focus more on data science than pure psychology.
And moment 7. Please also complete this one. Thanks to my studies, I know that...
I don't know a lot. I think this is the thing. The more I learn, the more questions I get. So I'm humble, very humble.
Thank you. Because of your interview here today, our conversation here today, I think we know a lot more about information systems, and that we are still at an early stage in dealing with all of this, although it seems like a huge impact right now. There is more to come. And that means, of course, more research to be done on this as well. So all the very best for that particular research.
Thank you. And thank you very much for having me. It was really interesting. And I think at least the last 7 questions were also very thought-provoking for me.
Thank you. And to our audience, please stay tuned for our next conversations that are always based on what is made in science. My name is Wolfgang Holtkamp. Have a great podcast day. Goodbye and good talking.